The meeting, the Committee of Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance to order. We'll start with the roll call.
Johnson.
Here.
Lohmer.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Becker Finn.
Here.
Considine. Dean.
Here.
Frankie.
Here.
Grossel. Howe. Lucero. Newberger.
Here.
O'Neill.
Here.
Pinto.
Here.
Uglum.
Here.
Ward. Zerwas.
Here. Just to function.
First of all, I'd like to welcome everybody here. We're going to have an interesting meeting today. We have a few things to do. For those of you that are sitting here, the committee's decision to move over here, but with what's going on, it was the Sergeant-at-Arms office just to make sure everything is safe. So with that, is there anybody willing to have a chance to look at the minutes and to approve them?
Oh, that's it.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Wilmer moves the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are moved. Start off with today, we're going to start out with the presentation by the Department of Public Safety on their bonding request. I'll ask Commissioner Doman and Director Kelly to come forward.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. We're trying to see if we're online here to show the PowerPoint that we have.
See if we can get that working here real briefly. Commissioner, we do have a copy of the presentation if you want to get started while they try to get the bugs out of the system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mona Doman, and I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. So good morning, and we really appreciate the opportunity to be with you today, Mr. Chair and members, to present our bonding project that we have been talking about for many years, and I think many of you are very much aware of it. This is a public safety project with statewide impact. It's an investment in a stable, secure, and redundant emergency operations center, which is critical to meet the needs of local government. We know that all disasters are local. They happen in the areas of Minnesota that you represent and that we all serve. They happen on a road in a city or county or in a region, and they can happen at any time of the day or night anywhere around the state. When disasters happen and local governments simply don't have the resources to respond and recover, they call upon the state. They call on the Department of Public Safety to help. When we get the call, we implement the state's emergency operations plan, and we activate the State Emergency Operations Center, where we coordinate state resources in our efforts to assist our public safety partners and the communities that they serve. There is a common misperception that the Emergency Operations Center sits empty and quiet until an emergency happens. In reality, the EOC and our Homeland Security and Emergency Management offices are very busy. Since 2010, the EOC has been activated for disaster response a total of 465 days. HSEM has hosted many events over the last 5 years, and Director Kelly will talk more about that when he gives the PowerPoint presentation. And those events are not counting our daily activities. It is heavily used for trainings, exercises, meetings, conferences, and media events. Actually, it is a very busy place, even without emergencies. The current EOC is located in downtown St. Paul in a busy, mixed-use, and densely developed area. It sits right on top of a public underground parking ramp, and its street-level exterior wall is literally 12 feet from the light rail tracks. We have no ability to secure the approaches to the facility. The doors to the EOC are our first and last access barriers. Director Kelly, our Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, could tell you and probably will share stories of security concerns at our facility. If you have not had an opportunity, Mr. Chair, or any of you members, we invite you to come and visit us so that you can see it firsthand at any time. We believe these shortcomings are unacceptable for the one-of-a-kind, critical, no-fail public safety and continuity of government facility. The people of Minnesota, the people that you represent and that we all serve, depend on us to be there on a bad day when they need us the most. The investment for this project is $33.6 million. The legislature previously saw the need and appropriated money for planning and design. I hope that you will agree that it's time to move forward on this project. Thank you for your support of the work that we do to keep the people of Minnesota safe. They count on all of us, and this investment is one way to reassure them that we will be there when they need us. Director Kelly.
Director, please state your name and the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Joe Kelly. I serve as the Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management with the Department of Public Safety. Thank you for the opportunity to brief you on this project. I will start by very quickly explaining what it is that we do in the State Emergency Operations Center. As the Commissioner said, all emergencies and disasters are local events. And when the requirements to respond to or recover from an incident are beyond the capacity of a county, city, townships, or tribal government, they call the state for assistance. And those calls are received in the State Emergency Operations Center, or as we refer to it, the State EOC. Representatives from more than 24 state agencies, volunteer organizations, the federal government, and many other partners assemble in the EOC to coordinate that assistance to our communities when they're having those bad days. For large incidents, the number of people working in the state EOC can approach 200. For some context, the kind of incidents that we're talking about include the major spring floods in the Red River Valley, the devastating tornadoes that in past years hit places like St. Peter, Wadena, and North Minneapolis, the 35W bridge collapse, the 2012 hazardous material spill down at the Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant, the spring ice storms of 2013 down in the southwestern corner of the state, and multiple flash floods caused by high-volume summer rains in places like Rushford, Duluth, and most recently in 2016, Waseca and the counties of South Central Minnesota. Because of our dynamic weather, Minnesota is, believe it or not, one of the most disaster-prone states in the nation. Over the past 10 years, the President has declared 20 disasters and authorized federal disaster assistance to recover from those incidents. Since the legislature created our state disaster assistance program in 2014, the governor has authorized its use 24 times for incidents not rising to the level qualifying for federal assistance. And as the commissioner said, we think it'd be totally unacceptable if when local government called for help, the state wasn't there to answer those calls. And that's why we need a dependable state emergency operations center. Commissioner Doman said that the EOC is a very busy place even without emergencies. And just to repeat the numbers that she said, it has been activated 465 days to assist local communities with emergency response, disaster recovery, and security at special events since 2010. It is used hundreds of days every year by state agencies and local governments for things like training, exercising, meetings, conferences, and media events. To be dependable, the state EOC must have all of these attributes you see on the screen. Available means that it is located outside of risk areas and is not affected by severe weather. Operational means that it has effective, reliable, and redundant infrastructures. Functional means it's properly sized and has the required operating capabilities. Secure means we can control access to it and protect its critical functions. And our current facility falls short in all of these factors, creating a risk of our ability to support local communities during emergencies. Additionally, continuity of government, which is the relocating of the seat of state government to an alternate location if the Capitol complex is untenable or unavailable, requires dependable facilities. In our current state emergency operations center, just a few blocks away, is poorly located and inadequately configured to support that effort. The current EOC is located in the Town Square complex in downtown St. Paul. As the commissioner said, one of the more alarming deficiencies is that we sit right on top of a public parking ramp. If you look at the picture on the right side of the slide, you can see a couple of those deficiencies. One, that red banner is the entrance to that parking ramp where vehicles sit right underneath us. Second is the 12 paces to the light rail line. And the third is that glass wall that's running down the street. That is the exterior wall to the State Emergency Operations Center. And that is a very soft wall. It is made of plate glass, some framing, and sheetrock, which affords little to no protection for a critical facility. We have single feeds for power and for communications. We have a backup generator, but it's old, unreliable, and very expensive to maintain. And as the commissioner said, because we're on the street level of a downtown high-rise area, our options for alternate communications, if we lose our primaries, things like satellite, radio, etc., are very limited because we're in a canyon of tall buildings. We have no ability to secure the approaches to our facility. If you came to our office, you'd walk in the front door, you'd meet our receptionist, Sandra. Although that door is locked, that's it. There are restaurants, coffee shops, etc., right outside our front door. We have no ability to create some sort of standoff, if you will, in the case where we get into an environment where security needs to be taken to the next level. These shortcomings and more, we believe, are unacceptable, as the boss said, for a one-of-a-kind facility that serves the entire state. It's a critical, no-fail public safety and continuity of government that the people of Minnesota depend on. We currently lease 22,000 square feet in that Town Square complex, and we're paying a little more than $500,000 for that, and we're paying $500,000 for a facility with inadequate power, communications, and network infrastructure. Just a couple key points on that. During the pre-design study, which was completed for a new facility several years ago, professional architects and engineers calculated, based on our staff, the functions that we need to perform in the environment that we need to do it in, they calculated our space requirements at 65,000 square feet, so three times what we currently have. Now, we have reduced the scope of this project to about 52,000 square feet by leveraging our partnership with the Department of Military Affairs, the Minnesota National Guard, and planning to use their adjacent Arden Hills facilities when we need them. So we're trying to, through partnership with other agencies and state government, avoid the costs of building more facility than we need. Second, using cost factors, it would only cost from the Building Owners Management Association, it would only cost 7% more a year on an annual basis to operate and maintain the facility that we're proposing that is much larger and certainly much more functional and more secure than the one we have right now. In other words, for an additional $36,000 a year, We would have a dependable facility with all those shortcomings and risks eliminated that's 2.5 times larger than our current space. Additionally, we would be investing in a state asset instead of paying rent. As the commissioner said, the investment for this project is $33.6 million. And as members know, this is not a new issue. This goes back at least 10 years prior to the current administration. Now, the legislature previously appropriated money, and with that money, we completed the pre-design work. We also conducted a legislatively directed traffic study to validate that Arden Hills was the best site for this facility. And we are now ready to move forward with the design and construction of a dependable new state emergency operations center. Here's a breakdown of that $33.6 million. The building site is on excess federal property where the former Twin Cities Army Ammunition Plant was located for many years. And that will be transferred to the state at no cost. The pre-design work that I mentioned earlier was completed, but we were unable to get the design work done before the money expired. Mr. Chair and members, thank you again for the opportunity to present this important public safety bonding project to you today. Mr. Chair, do you or the members have any questions?
Mr. Kelly, I do have one question. Is this project on the governor's bonding request? And if not, do you know why?
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. The governor has included this project in a previous bonding bill, but as you know, there's competing interests for bonding projects and money. And so his priorities this year in his bonding bill were investments in higher education, clean water, and asset preservation. And so this project is not in his bonding bill, but he is supportive of this project.
Thank you. Representative Pilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, previously I've heard about this site and that there were questions on whether or not there were cleanup issues. Does this dollar amount take into account any land cleanup that might need to occur given the what it was previously?
Dr. Kelly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, yes is the short answer. The longer answer is I know there's concern about the contamination of the soils and waters in that area caused by the Army's industrial operations over there for many decades. The Army has cleaned that up to industrial standards, so there is no responsibility on the part of the state to clean up or decontaminate the land. There is, and included in there, I think it's $1.6 million for the demolition of some structures that are currently located on the site that are leftover buildings from the plant. But the environmental contamination has been dealt with. There are still some surveying that goes on. There's some water that's being circulated, but that is the responsibility of the Department of Defense, and their lawyers tell us they cannot escape the liability from that. So if in the future something else is discovered that needs to be cleaned up environmentally, that will be the federal government's responsibility.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up with that, and if the environmental standard changes, would they keep the liability to clean it up to the new environmental standard?
Director Kelly?
Mr. Chair, Senator, or Representative Hillstrom, I believe the answer to that is yes, but it would depend on if it's a federal change in the federal standard. Certainly, if the state implies a higher standard, I would have to consult with some legal counsel on that.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see you again, Commissioner and Director Kelly. The question I have is, and I'm not quite sure if I've seen it right, but I believe that the lease runs out on September of this year, so I assume that you're not going to be this, even if we approve this, we won't be moving the EOC anytime soon. But I would think that with the deficiencies in the current place, have we looked at what we have available to us in the state facilities? And I know even on the Capitol complex that we could possibly move that to and improve our current situation in the interim while that's being, if this gets approved, if it's under construction, I mean, during that time period.
Director Kelly?
Mr. Chair and Representative Howe, on the issue of the expiring lease, the Department of Public Safety is renegotiating a lease for the other elements of the department that will stay in the Town Square complex, and we will be included in that up front with an exit clause, if you will, that if a new facility is built, we would be able to break our lease and move out to the new facility. I am not aware of any other state buildings that are within the Capitol complex or within easy reach that are available that would either meet all our requirements or be any better than what we currently have. If the legislature approved funding for this project, we project that it would be until the 1st of June 2020 before we would be able to take occupancy of a new facility. So we believe our best course of action would be to stay where we are under that lease until the facility is ready.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, you know, with the Commissioner and Director Kelly, my concern is with the vulnerabilities that we see in there with the glass and everything else, I would believe it would behoove us to move that at the earliest possible convenience, because I would see that as a high threat to relocate. But that's my opinion. Thank you.
I believe there's a Rick Larkin that also wants to testify on this. Is he in the room? Go ahead and state your name and your organization and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Rick Larkin. I'm the recently retired Director of Emergency Management for the City of St. Paul, but I'm here today in my capacity as the past president of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers. Our association represents about 400-plus emergency management professionals across the state, and that includes all of the directors of the counties, cities of the first class, as well as our associate members who are emergency management professionals, perhaps from private industry or others. We are here today as an association, as we have been since 2000, actually, 2001, when the attacks of 9/11 occurred. Our association and others provided support for this initiative to move the state EOC out of the city of St. Paul, simply because of all of the various reasons that Director Kelly has laid out. Our members protect their own communities and provide multi-agency coordination at the local level. So the local jurisdictions, as Director Kelly likes to say, all disasters are local, and that is true. Our members are out there assisting those who are on the front lines, the incident commanders in the field, the responders in the field. Our folks are in their own EOCs locally. Our association is in full support of having a functional, robust, defendable state EOC that needs to be in place when we call for assistance. But I would also like to reinforce that this is not a state office building or another state agency kind of thing. This is something that serves the entire state. And your members, constituents members are being served by this unique facility. And it's important to us that we have a robust and reliable system at the local level where things are happening, as well as at the state level where we reach out for assistance and all the state agencies come together physically to provide assistance to that affected community. The other piece that they provide is the entry point for federal assistance, and that includes state assistance to the territory of Puerto Rico, coordinating folks going to Puerto Rico and Florida to assist others. That all happens from your state EOC, and that is our connection at the local level. So the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers feels that it's a vital public safety infrastructure and that this function needs to be capable, ready, and able to serve the citizens of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm on. Thank the testifiers for coming forward and bringing this to us. I do believe it is an important issue. Years ago, I was an emergency director for my community, so I understand the issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And members.
Next, we're going to go through the corrections bonding request. If Commissioner Roy, Deputy Commissioner Reiser, and Capital Resource Administrator. I might have trouble with this. Wisniewski?
Wisniewski, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner Roy, if you could introduce yourself, and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections. It's nice to be assembled with you folks again. To my left is Bruce Reiser, our Deputy Commissioner in charge of facilities. To my right, David Wisniewski, our new Capital Resources Administrator. I'm going to start the presentation and quickly turn it over to these gentlemen who have great expertise in the area of facilities and programming and population. We have a presentation this morning that should be efficient with your time. It is one that there's nothing fancy in this bonding request, and I believe, doggone it, that that is the mandate of government. Nothing fancy. We get the job done. And this bonding proposal deals with aging facilities, it deals with some population solutions, and it is supported by the governor, and I think I am pleased to say that I have, over the years, come to respect that you folks get our mission. You know that the work we do is essential to the state. You know that it is difficult work. You know that we have 10,000 folks in our facilities, and we have about 4,000 employees that often enter those facilities. The condition and the capacity of our facilities are directly related to safety. And at the end of the day, safety is the key word in our business. So I believe Deputy Reiser will take it from here, and I'll jump in a couple slides later, and thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thanks for the opportunity for us to present our bonding requests. We have four requests that we're going to present, and it's also in the governor's budget. Our highest priority, as it is every year, every 2 years, is asset preservation. Our facilities operate 24/7, 365 days a year. The clientele that we have in our facilities is hard on the physical plant, and so it does require a lot of maintenance and upkeep. The asset preservation maintains our facility to ensure a safe, secure environment for staff, offenders, and the public. Requests number 2 and 3 are Lionel Lakes building renovation, and I'll discuss some of this in further later in the presentation, and also Willow River Challenge Incarceration Program. We're looking at adding specialized units in these two facilities to assist in some programmatic issues and also to increase our population for the department. Item number 4, St. Cloud Plumbing and Ventilation. St. Cloud has about 394 cells and 3 cell blocks where the plumbing and the pipe chases is failing. There's no ventilation into the rooms, and so
It's been an asset preservation need that's been identified. Just a little overview of corrections, the size of our facilities, the number of buildings. The Department of Corrections oversees and operates and maintains 11 prison facilities, more than 300 buildings totaling 6 million square feet. The age of the facilities range from 30 to 127 years old and are experiencing several different stages of disrepair as established by the Department of Administration's facility condition audit. As you look down the slide, 13 buildings in crisis condition, 47 in poor condition, 148 average, 93 in good, and 15 of the buildings in excellent condition. As stated, we have old facilities. Stillwater Red Wing were built in 1889. Stillwater built in 1914. We've acquired some regional treatment centers and converted them to prisons. Faribault was built in 1879. A lot of the buildings at Faribault have been demolished and new buildings put in its place. Moose Lake built in 1937. So as you can see, these are not new shiny buildings. They're old and they do need a lot of repairs and upkeep. We also have many types of buildings within the correctional system, ranging all the way from heavy industry type buildings to clinics to housing units to education units and so office areas. So it does take a lot of different types of asset preservation to maintain these variety of different buildings and usages. Agency priority number one, as I stated, is asset preservation. We are requesting $40 million. We have a growing need. Greater investment in asset preservation is needed to take care of our infrastructure, to keep it safe, secure, and in a usable condition. We have failed to adequately fund asset preservation, resulting in a growing deferred maintenance backlog. It's cheaper to fix it first. Investment in asset preservation extends useful life of our infrastructure. Failure to keep up with growing needs results in a higher cost in the future. And protect state's investment. Over the years, the state has made significant investment in the Department of Corrections in many of its structures. It is important that we protect the state's investment by allowing our facilities to continue to, by not continuing to deteriorate and fall into disrepair. Under the goals of the $40 million is to protect state investment, reduce costs through repairs, ensure compliance with health and safety regulations, ensure the safety of corrections officers, staff, offenders, and the public, and to create an environmental safety with adequate septic systems and improved plumbing. The next slides, Mr. Wisniewski will present.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'd like to get into a little bit more detail regarding asset preservation. As mentioned previously, the request is for $40 million in funding. And this reflects the top five critical items per facility. So having 11 correctional facilities, that equates to 55 projects that we'd be looking at. Now, the needs are great, and the list is long. And the graphic that we're looking at here has two significant numbers. The $232 million is basically what would be needed to essentially catch up. And catch up is defined as, again, deferred maintenance or things that have been, for the most part, been put into working condition, but imminent failure is on the horizon. Another graphic here, $284 million, reflects replacement over 10 years of HVAC systems, electrical systems, things of that nature. And the reason for that is a lot of these systems have reached the end of their useful life. There's a lot of manufacturers that do not support the equipment anymore. So that is something to be cognizant of as we move forward, is that we do have failing systems out there. So if we were to add all of the two major categories here, we're looking at $516 million over the next 10 years to bring our facilities out of the crisis and poor modes to good facilities, which means we've now addressed the majority of the critical pieces when it comes to maintenance and equipment replacement. The Department of Admin has come up with a formula in which would reflect per biennium what would be the amount of funding required to get us to that point of having the good category of facilities. That number is $171 million per biennium. However, being good stewards of the taxpayer funding, we are requesting the $40 million to take care of the top five critical projects per facility. And I would like to add that the top five are something that we get from the facility condition assessment, as well as our physical plant staff that live these critical projects daily and have extremely good input as to the severity of the situation. The next slide essentially represents the five categories that we see in asset preservation. 40% is life safety, code compliance, hazardous material abatement, and others. And of the $40 million, that represents 16.5 million. Second category is heating, ventilation, cooling replacements, 24%. Or 9.6 million of that amount. Next category, 20% of building envelopes, roof, walls, foundation, window replacement, general building infrastructure is what we're talking about here at 7.6 million. 12% or 4.7 million goes to mechanical, plumbing, and electrical system upgrades. And the last category is renewal and emergent needs at $1.6 million, or 4% of the overall $40 million. To give you an idea of some of the issues we face out there, this slide represents, again, electrical, fire suppression, mechanical, failing infrastructure that, again, needs a lot of attention. In some cases, failure is imminent, and we would be addressing some of these projects in an emergency mode, which it's always better to be proactive than reactive in situations like this. And as you heard previously, some of our facilities are 100 years plus in age, and they do not have any fire suppression systems within them. And life safety is a very high priority, and part of the $40 million addresses getting fire suppression in the living units, as well as you know, promoting safety for staff and in the admin areas. So with that, I'll turn it back to Deputy Commissioner Reiser.
Mr. Chair, committee members, our priority two and three requests are bonding for needed bed space. Priority two is at our Lionel Lakes facility for 60 beds at $5.2 million. Priority three is at our Willow River Challenge Incarceration Program in Willow River, 45 beds, $1.7 million. Both of these requests add specialized beds and specialized, give us the ability to do some specialized programming to assist offenders with living in the facilities and actually hopefully providing opportunities for them to change their lives and move out and stay in the community and not come back to the corrections. Both requests are within existing facility infrastructure, so both of these requests would be in Lionel Lakes is inside the fence already, and Willow River CIP already has 180 men that are involved in that program, so we'd just be expanding that program. The next two slides are population, and I believe Commissioner Roy will be talking about that.
So priorities two and three, and these graphs that you're looking at now are...
Commissioner Roy, I believe Representative Dean has a question.
Yeah, to that point, Mr. Chair, and... can you explain why the cost per bed in Lionel Lakes is $87,000 per bed versus Willow River, $38,000 per bed. Is that because of programming? Is that because of security in the facility? Can you sort of give us a sense on why there's that difference?
Commissioner Roy?
I'll take that. The buildings are different status. The Lionel building has asbestos and requires some significant deconstruction and reconstruction. The facility at Willow will be new construction and will serve multiple needs. And we will be visiting you folks for staffing needs in the future.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the previous slide on the asset preservations. I noticed that there's nothing in here about Thistledew. I know that Thistledew was closed. It had a plumbing problem, so there are no more boys at Thistledew. What are you doing with that facility, and did you do anything to address the plumbing problems which cause us to not be able to use it to its full capacity?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, right now Thistledew, which is Togo, is at a capacity of 95 men, and we're also running a challenge incarceration program there. The septic system does have to be replaced. We are utilizing some asset preservation funding to do that. We are currently pumping the systems every month to ensure that we comply with health regulations. So we are operational, and we are moving forward with repairing those plumbing systems with current funding and asset preservation.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you successfully do that, what does the capacity become at that facility?
Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, the capacity would be at 115 when that's all done.
Please continue.
Mr. Chair, to continue, the population priority 2 and 3, this is a pretty conservative request to add these 105 beds. We will obviously do a future presentation on our entire population, but I think it's important today to at least indicate to you what our short-term growth has been, what our current status is. The slide number 9 indicates that we are over capacity already, but the story is improving. At one time when I talked to you folks about the use of county jails for our housing out of facility program, we had over 500 people in county jails. We are now down to 205. The attention given to overpopulation, we have experienced some good programming in the community. We're telling the story to our county partners that probation violations and parole violations are coming back in great numbers. I think our county partners are helping and stepping up. We had hoped that the drug reform would affect our population, your work last year. And I understand next week you might be having a presentation from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and Director Wrights will be going into detail of the impact of those. Unfortunately, with that drug reform, concurrently is the drug growth. Mr. Backstrom, county attorney in Dakota County, and I were just talking about his statistics, and drug cases are skyrocketing. Basically, in his county, they tripled in 4 years. That skyrocketing drug throughout the state that this is occurring, and meth is, again, the king of drugs in Minnesota. And that growth in the volume of drug crimes has negated the reforms. It's basically made those reforms neutral. So capacity is important to us. These bonding proposals will get to it. We have other initiatives that in the future I will express to you at another hearing, which would be more appropriate. But long-term, this slide is out into the future in greater detail, and you can see that at some point in time, this committee and the state are going to have to get serious, either in reforming guidelines, in building capacity, or investing in community programming, which can also have good results in, for prison population. So to go into more detail of the two, priority two and priority three, Deputy Reiser has already talked to a degree on both of these, so we can move quickly through these.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'd like to correct that number. It's actually 105, not 115, for the CIP at Togo. So Lionel Lakes, we are looking at, again, 60 beds. Majority of the renovation occurs inside of the shell of the building. The actual shell is in very good shape. It's been a vacant space at the Lionel Lakes facility for the past 12 years. It was a health services area, so it has to be gutted and renovated into offender housing. We just put a new roof on it probably 4 years ago. And so, like I say, the majority of the construction is interior renovation, abatement, and the construction of the living unit, the cells, and to harden it up a little bit. The timeline for this project would be June of 18, and with an anticipated completion of January of 2021. Our agency priority three, the Willow River Challenge Incarceration Program, $1.7 million. It's to repurpose and construct some new space. It would increase the program by 45 beds and, again, add treatment and programming for additional offenders and continue with our mission of reducing recidivism. The actual project entails renovating a recreation or a health a weight room kind of area for a barracks for 45 offenders, and then adding a on-slab building about 4,000 square feet with classrooms, office space, and facilities for the offenders. And that is why the cost differential is so much, that the majority of this project is actually moving a 45 offenders from into a barrack setting, which is much cheaper construction than individual rooms at the Lionel Lake facility. The CIP program is 18-month program. Six months they're inside. It's military bearing type program at CIP. Last 12 months are in the community. If at any time they fail to comply with their directives, they immediately come back into the system and receive more time within the correction system. Our priority number four, which is St. Cloud plumbing and ventilation, $16.2 million. Replace plumbing fixtures and main sewer lines of deteriorating systems. Install ventilation systems. Right now, St. Cloud was built in 1910. The plumbing was added to these three housing units in 1950. And at that time, the codes were much different. A lot of the, all of the fixtures were attached to the cinder block walls. Over the years, it's starting to deteriorate, so the project would include supporting those cells, keeping the ability of the offenders to get through the cell wall to the pipe chase. Part of the construction is actually utilizing the pipe space to increase the ventilation so that the offender cells would ventilate out and up, and the airflow would actually have some airflow, which it doesn't right now. It would also include adding flush valves to the system, which would greatly increase the water efficiency and decrease the water usage of the facility. Right now it has a clay tile septic system or clay pipe that runs from the facility to the and connects with the city. Measuring the water flow, there is a little leakage, that the amount of water that goes in the system isn't always the same amount of water that comes out. So it would correct that system, and it would also add a water system, another water line coming into the facility, which in the future would assist us with sprinkling the cells. Right now, the water capacity into the facility isn't at the level that that we could actually sprinkle the cell. So it also would correct that issue and enable us to move forward with some other safety issues in the facility.
Mr. Chair, that concludes our presentation. We're focusing on our mission, and that is to reduce recidivism. We have far too many people coming back into our system, and while these bonding requests, sometimes tough to connect buildings and pipes and ventilation to recidivism, but we believe in a healthy environment. People are more likely to improve. And, of course, we are always interested in staff safety and environments that are decent to work in. Throughout the nation, departments of corrections are struggling to recruit staff, and some states are even thinking about calling out the National Guard to help staff prisons. And fortunately, in Minnesota, we provide an environment that is as attractive as it can be. It's still very, very tough work, and we're still struggling in some locations to recruit staff. But when we can say you're working in a safe environment, that really helps. So I appreciate this committee's attention to our projects, and I know all people on this committee are interested in public safety, so thank you very much.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that all of the bonding requests relate to male facilities. Is the Shakopee Women's Prison, other than the asset preservation, do they have what they need for the growth that you see? I don't see an expansion of beds requested for the female facility.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, if you recall, a state made a fairly substantial $6.5 million investment in the fence. That was the priority need at Shakopee, and if you folks haven't seen the fence at Shakopee, it turned out very nice, and the community is very happy. I think I could give you a list of 20 things that would help at Shakopee, but they are not in our request. We have a food service area that could certainly be expanded there, but it is functioning, and we still are very proud of that facility in terms of programming and its physical functions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tell me about the capacity. That was the question. Do you have the capacity that you need after this bonding request, because you're not asking for any bonding-related capacity for women?
Commissioner Wright.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sorry I missed your question. The capacity at Shakopee is serving us currently. It occasionally bumps up, and we do have 30 or so females in county jails and at the federal prison in Waseca.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is you, Commissioner, or Deputy Commissioner Reiser. So when I look at Lionel Lakes, the timeline is 2.5 years, and I'm curious, with a vacant building, why that timeline is so long.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Dean, I can answer that question. Specifically, we have done a study, but we have not gotten into any specific architectural design, and there is a significant amount of asbestos in the building given its age, and that takes some time to get done. And whenever there is a secured type design, such as incarceration, it's a little bit longer construction period because of the materials, the specifications required, and the means and methods required to get it to a level of being secured. So that's why it takes a little bit longer. And, you know, when it comes down to actually getting a consultant on board, we always strive to tighten up that timeline. This is kind of an estimate of what it could take, but we always try to stay away from potential escalation in materials, things of that nature, which is always an entanglement when it comes to budget. So we're always looking to tighten up those schedules so we can.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Commissioner Roy and your team for bringing me to 10 of the 11 prisons all summer and fall. It was very eye-opening, and and I know I ask a lot of questions, and your team was very gracious to answer them all and even took me behind to see these leaking water pipes, and I was worried something was going to fall on my head, but it didn't. Could have, but it was really, really in need of repair. It was unbelievable what I was able to see with my own eyes. So I just want to encourage, too, the committee members, if you haven't toured even one prison or two or three, it's really, they're all very, very unique and very different and have different programming and, you know, like Stillwater is very different than Shakopee. I mean, they're just incredibly different. So I encourage you to do that as well. And when we come and, you know, hear presentations like this, for me, I can visualize all this because I was there and saw it and understand the complexities, understand the deterioration that's right in front of us. So I just, one, wanted to thank you. And two, I also am very encouraged to hear the alternatives to incarceration work that we did collectively together, that that's actually paying off. And I know we had, I had talked with your deputy commissioner when we were in D.C., and we talked about maybe expanding that. So I'm looking forward to some more solutions of what else we can do. As you know, as you looked at the study, it was 60% in 2016 were sent back to the prison system because of a technical violation, not because a new crime had been committed. So there's a lot of work to be done there, and I'm sure some of them probably need to go back. But there are stories of people, you know, going back for 1 or 2 days and going through all of the process of intake and all of that that takes, and then being released, and sometimes not even released until after their release date because it took so long to take them in. So it just seems still incredibly cumbersome, and there's plenty of work to do there. So I look forward to continuing to work with you and figure out solutions for that. But I just wanted to let the committee know that I have actually looked at all 10 of the 11. I haven't been to Togo, but it's on my list. But and they are really in need of repair, and they're being very gracious to us to give us only $40 million. I can definitely see where you need $172. There's a lot of very not fancy, not shiny things that need to get fixed behind the doors and the crevices of the building. So thank you for presenting that, and I appreciate your graciousness to take me to 10 of the 11 prisons over the summer and fall. Thank you, Commissioner Roy.
Appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Commissioner, I want to thank you and your team for coming here today and presenting this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Okay, before we get started on the next bill, I'm going to remind we have some, because of time restraints, we do have some rules for these next two bills. There will be a strict time limit of 15 minutes for the both sides of this issue. After that, action will be taken. We ask that people in the audience please remain quiet because acoustics aren't always the greatest in this room, and we want to make sure everybody's able to hear what's going on. Representative Pino, do you have a motion on this bill?
Mr. Chair, I do. I understand that the next step for the bill will be to go to the Civil Law Committee. And so, Mr. Chair, members, I move that House File 1669 be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee as the next step in consideration in the process.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, thank you for your patience this past week. The decision to finally push for hearings for these two bills was not made lightly, but members, we face a crisis. In the year that these bills have been sitting and awaiting a hearing, well over 30,000 Americans, nearly 1,300 children, have died from gunshots. Many more have been wounded. These are rates many times higher than in other industrialized countries. Also, in this past year, millions of Americans, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans, have used firearms for hunting, for recreation and sport, as a hobby, for personal protection. Members, we can keep guns, more guns out of the hands of dangerous people, and also uphold the rights of those Minnesotans. We can do both, we must do both, and these two bills today do just that. The first bill, House File 1669, has to do with criminal background checks. Under current law, a criminal background check applies to sales of firearms through through FFLs, federal firearms licensees, basically through dealers, but not sales through other people. House File 1669 takes the background check that applies to sales through dealers, the many sales through dealers, and applies that to all gun sales with, I should note, common sense exceptions such as transfers within the family and a number of other exceptions as well. This is an approach, members, that's in use right now in many states with different variations. It's being used right now. Having a criminal background check on all sales is supported by the great majority of Minnesotans, the great majority of Republicans, the great majority of owners of firearms. Now, as members know, outside the legislature, I serve as a prosecutor. I have specialized in domestic and sexual violence cases, but I've handled a wide variety of cases, including cases where violent felons were in possession of guns. Now, right now, a background check will prevent a violent felon or other prohibited person from acquiring a gun through an FFL, through a dealer. And that happens, by the way, about 150,000 times a year, that someone who's prohibited is prevented from getting a gun because of this background check system, because they go through that door. But there's no background check if that same prohibited person buys through someone else. Members, that does not make any sense. Responsible gun owners don't want their firearms to end up in the hands of people who are not allowed to have them. Polls show that they, like all Minnesotans, strongly support having criminal background checks on all sales of firearms. So I'm going to call up my first testifier, Chief Knight.
Chief Knight, if you could state your name and start your...
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, members of the public. My name is Scott Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. I'm the Chief of Police in the City of Chaska. I'm also a past president of the Minnesota Chiefs. I served as the Firearms Committee Chair for the International Association of Chiefs of Police for a number of years, and I'm a former chair of the National Law Enforcement Partnership to Prevent Gun Violence. I'm here representing Minnesota Chiefs today in support of what you have just heard in regard to background checks. You're aware that if someone were to buy a weapon from a FFL, federally licensed dealer, they go through a check. It's pretty well known that about 40% of gun transaction sales don't go through a background check, and which means that people who would otherwise be prohibited from procuring a firearm can and do. They can get them online, they can go to a gun show, they can go to a garage sale, they can answer an ad in the paper and get a transaction to have a weapon without knowing whether or not they're a prohibited person. Minnesota Chiefs has always, and we continue to support the expansion of comprehensive background checks. We ask you to consider this, please.
And Mr. Chair, I'll bring up the second testifier, Dakota County Attorney Jim Backstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney, member of the Board of Directors and past president of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I do have a handout if someone could pass that out. I'd appreciate it. What I'm handing out is the position of Minnesota County Attorneys Association in reference to a statement of principles on firearms, which we adopted in October of 2016, but it's still applicable today. It specifically relates to the bill in front of you, the 1669 bill regarding the background checks, because we do support a common sense approach to background checks, which requires all sellers, with a few exceptions, which I'll go into, but all sellers of guns to make sure that there are background checks done. I believe the vast majority of citizens in our state and in our nation, quite frankly, support this type of a proposal. It makes common sense. The exceptions, as articulated in this document, would be sales for interfamilial, within a family, sales of weapons. And we would also encourage you, as you consider adopting a bill of this nature, to exclude long arms, the shotguns, the rifles that do not constitute semi-automatic type assault weapons, which we believe should always go through background checks. But those types of weapons which are used for hunting, which we have a long and proud tradition of here in our great state, would support not changing the rules in reference to that. But clearly with reference to handguns and semi-automatic assault weapons, background checks need to take place in reference to all sales, whether they're done through a federal licensed arms dealer or not. We simply have, as Representative Pinto alluded to, we have an epidemic of gun violence in this country. There was over 33,000 people in the United States that died last year as a result of gun violence. Over 85,000 or almost 85,000 more suffered non-fatal gun injuries. We need to adopt common-sense approaches to address these issues. The second bill in front of you today, 1605, my state association has not had time to review and consider this proposal, but I believe we will support this. I personally support this proposal. Again, it makes common sense for those in situations where there is an element of danger that either law enforcement or a family member should be able to obtain a protective order to prohibit someone from possessing a firearm under those circumstances. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today and testify in reference to these matters.
And then finally, my third testifier, who serves as a pediatrician.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Andrew Kiragu, K-I-R-A-G-U, and I'm the president of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. I'm also currently the interim chief of pediatrics and the medical director of the intensive care unit at Hennepin County Medical Center. I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify before you about the importance of the criminal background check bill that's under consideration at this time. As an intensive care physician in a level one pediatric trauma center, I have had the privilege of taking care of children that are critically ill or seriously injured for almost 20 years. Unfortunately, given the nature of the work I do, I see a fair amount of suffering experienced by the most vulnerable of those amongst us, our children. Death and devastating life-changing disability are some of the saddest things that I've had to deal with. I am especially saddened when the injuries could have been easily prevented. Outrage, heartbreak, and frustration are just a few of the emotions I've experienced every time I see a child who has been senselessly injured or killed by a gun. I'm here speaking on behalf of the over 1,000 pediatricians who are members of the Minnesota AAP. As pediatricians, we are tasked for caring for the most vulnerable of our citizens, our nation's children. We are horrified by the carnage wrought on children by guns and mourn with their families. We believe that firearm violence is a serious public health issue and that one that policymakers can no longer ignore, especially when firearm-related deaths are among one of the top three causes of death in American youth. We are here speaking in strong support of HF 1669. While no single law will stop all gun violence, expanding the background check system is a proven way to help to save lives. Background checks have prevented millions of firearms from landing in the hands of dangerous individuals. Ladies and gentlemen, you have this momentous opportunity to make Minnesota's children safer. I urge you not to waste this chance. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just to make a few concluding remarks then to this testimony.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I want to emphasize that this is a bipartisan proposal. At the state level, I see Representative Anselmo here is in support. Of course, at the federal level, President Trump came out support yesterday and others as well. This is in use in a variety of states, and over a number of years it's been in use. And I'd like members just to have us be thinking about going to the airport. And there's the security line at the airport, and there's a screening that goes through to make sure that when somebody gets on a plane, we're sure that that person is going to be safe to be on the plane. Right now, we have that security line, sales to FFLs, and there's a separate access point that people can walk right on through that does not have the same sort of screening. It may be that most of the people on the plane, this is not a problem for. Each of us, it would not be a problem for. But I would feel much more comfortable when I'm on that plane knowing that there's not that there was not that, that second entrance that does not have the same background check as the first one. And I want to emphasize that as you hear the testimony to follow, to keep in mind that we are talking about the same background check conducted on many sales. I think the chief misspoke a little bit earlier. He referenced as many as 40% of sales not receiving the background check. I think you have some information indicating that actually it's a significantly lower percentage that do not have a background check, perhaps more like 10 to 15%. That's still a number of sales that are not receiving the background check that all those other sales are receiving and that are catching 150,000 people a year who are prohibited from having access and should not be having access to firearms. So keep in mind, as you consider this, that this is simply proposing to have the same check that's being done right now on apparently 85% of sales. Let's make sure that that covers up to 100% and keep more weapons out of the hands of the people who are not allowed to have them. Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much for listening to this testimony.
Representative Pinto, thank you. At this time, I have Rob Dort.
Mr. Chair, should I stay up here? Would you like me to go back to my seat? What's your preference?
That would be your option.
Yeah, that's
good
for you.
Yeah, that's good for me.
I'll stay out of your way, though.
Can you state your name and begin?
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rob Dorr, D-O-A-R, and I represent the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. I'm the political director. We speak on behalf of Minnesota's 2.5 million law-abiding gun owners and advocate on their behalf. First off, I just want to say that we do believe that this bill is unconstitutional. And while I understand that not everybody sees it that way, I want to try to appeal to a little bit of logic. We heard here that there is an epidemic of gun violence. I'd like to point out that from the 1990s, our firearm homicide rate is lower than 50% of what it used to be. We are moving in the right direction. At the same time, gun sales and permit to carries have skyrocketed. And I think we are moving in the right direction. Another thing I'd like to point out, too, is that 78% of our gun deaths are suicides. That's tragic. But the strategies to address gun violence and the strategies to address suicides compared to violent crime are vastly different strategies. There's not a catch-all. And I believe that conversation is worth having. You've heard that the vast majority of gun owners support proposals like this. We conducted a survey of our membership last year, and once we applied the specific language of this bill and bills like it and the restrictions, there's 95% opposition to bills like this. People generally support the idea of background checks, but when you talk about the restrictions on transfers, the restrictions on loans, loaning somebody a firearm to go hunting for the weekend, that's when they start to really fall off once you actually address the specific issues. I'm glad that Representative Pinto corrected the 40% of gun sales happen without a background check. That number has been debunked over and over again. It's a 20-year-old survey of 250 people that included data prior to background checks becoming law. The Washington Post has given that lie four Pinocchios over and over again. I also wanted to say that we do have empirical data. Washington State has recently enacted universal background checks, as they call it. They've identified that 2% of their sales, their transfers, have been through private parties or third parties. So there's numbers that say 10 to 12%, but the empirical data shows about 2% from Washington actually go through private parties. We know through the Department of Justice studies that the vast majority of criminals get their firearms through straw purchases. The guns are going through background checks, but they are strategically and feloniously abusing the system in order to get those firearms. This bill does not address that. There's a lot of other things that I could go into. I want to make sure that we get the opinions of some of our other members here who want to speak in opposition to this bill. But I'm happy to answer any questions. You guys can find me in the halls. I'm here every day. It's not too hard to miss me.
Thank you. Ben Rust.
Morning, Chair Johnson and the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Ben Rust. I'm the General Counsel for the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. As you've already heard, often these debates devolve into a battle of statistics, and the personal stories of how these laws actually affect people are lost. I'm here today to tell you the story of my client and friend, Abdul Qadir Mohammed. I practice primarily in the area of wills, trusts, and probate, but through some unusual twists and turns, I found myself doing gun trusts. As an outgrowth of that practice, I started getting calls from people who tried to buy a gun at a gun shop and were denied. And that's how I came to know Abdul Qadir Mohammed, or as his friends call him, Abdul. Abdul was born in Somalia in 1984. I don't recall from our conversations when he first came to the United States, but he's lived in St. Cloud, or moved to St. Cloud in 2000. He became a citizen of the United States in January of 2013. And the reason I know that is because it appears in the affidavit of identity that I prepared and submitted to the FBI on his behalf. You see, Abdul tried to buy a gun, but was flagged as a prohibited person. This surprised him because he's gone through an extensive background check to become a citizen. He has a permit to carry a handgun from the state of Minnesota, and he's also licensed as an armed security guard in the state of Minnesota. And yet he did not pass the background check. The reason Abdul was licensed as a security guard is so that he could provide security for the Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center in Bloomington. After his transfer was denied, Abdul spent weeks going from lawyer to lawyer. None of them were able to help him until he came to me. And he and I met probably a half dozen times. We spent many hours going through the records to try and get his record cleared. It involved getting certified court records from multiple states. We went through it. We were able to successfully submit a NICS appeal. And his denial was overturned. The date on the letter was July 11th from the FBI. But that's not the end of Abdul's story, because the overturning of the NICS denial only applies if it was done within 30 days. Abdul tried to buy his gun April 30th, so he had to go back to the gun shop and start all over again. And sure enough, on his second attempt to buy a gun, he was denied yet again, and so he had to wait. He was not able to actually obtain a gun until July 28th of 2017. On August 5th of 2017, Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center was bombed. And I'm not here to tell you that my client could have prevented that bombing if he'd had a gun and was providing armed security. Rather, I mention that bombing to show that there is a real need for security there, and that the man standing ready to provide that security couldn't obtain a firearm to do it, because he didn't pass a background check. Under current law in Minnesota, Abdul could have obtained a gun legally through a private sale. If universal background checks are enacted, he would not have been able to do that. And the process in Abdul's case happened rather quickly, I mean, startlingly quickly. If you talk to other firearms attorneys, they'll tell you that those processes take 2 years. In fact, it says that right on the letter that another client of mine with a Muslim name received from the FBI. That's a long time to wait to exercise a constitutional right. I don't think that's fair. As you're considering this bill, I know there's a lot of statistics, but I would ask that you just remember Abdul, think about his story, remember that this law affects ordinary people. Thank you.
Daniel Ward. Please state your name for the record.
Daniel Ward. I am the Vice President and Director of Membership for the African American Heritage Gun Club here in Minnesota. And I just wanted to come today and give you a different perspective. When looking at guns in America, a lot of us tend to look at guns and gun clubs as being part of the old white establishment. We as minorities and people of color have traditionally been marginalized. We've been prohibited from being able to have just the basic right of being able to protect our homes and protect our families. Gun laws go all the way back to the early 1600s, and law after law after law after law after law has been passed that has basically eroded away not only our rights, but everyone else's rights. But we're the ones that get affected the most. We typically live in communities where the police over-police, we're profiled, we live in substandard housing, we can't find employment. You just had members from another agency that talked about the number of beds in facilities, and it's a problem that exists that's not going to go away. So if you look at this total universal background check, I want you to think about the people that are going to hurt the worst. We're talking about single moms. We're talking about very low-income individuals. I don't know of any gun store that's within the city limits of St. Paul or Minneapolis. Those have all been rezoned out of the areas. The vast majority of minorities live in urban areas, not in rural Minnesota. So those individuals that are also Minnesotans and citizens that pay taxes, citizens that love this state, citizens that love their city, citizens that are law-abiding, need protection as well. If I wanted to purchase a gun in the city of Minneapolis, I can't do so. I need to go out to the burbs. If I don't have transportation, because I'm dependent on public transportation, a lot of public transportation does not go to locations where the gun stores are. So again, I'm marginalized. I'm prohibited from being able to do this. Then as I read through this particular bill, I'm looking at just within our own club, if I wanted to sell a gun to a fellow club member, which I've known, trusted, gone to the range with, shot with, I'm not concerned about that person's going to go out and commit a crime. I know that person. I have a relationship with them. Okay? I have to then ask them to submit to a background check. I already know them. They're already a law-abiding citizen. They've already submitted to a background check. So why am I being required to do it again just to sell a gun to one of my friends that I go shoot with? That makes no sense to me. Online, we're looking at line 314. It talks about background checks by a federally licensed firearm dealer. The transferee shall appear jointly before a federal licensed firearm dealer with the firearm and the other person that you want to sell it to. If I got to hop on a bus and we're going to meet somewhere at a dealer that's out in the burbs, logistically, that's going to be very difficult in order to coordinate. So I would say that, you know, really consider some of the things here. Look at the people that don't have access. How are you making this more of a hurdle and more of a burden on them? Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Joe Olson. Mr. Olson, you have about 3 minutes.
Well, I will use up less than 3 minutes so that Ms. Cade can have a few moments, if you don't mind.
She's on the other bill.
Oh, she's on the other bill, but none of us. Oh, never mind. Never mind. My name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor of law at Mitchell-Hamlin Law School. I'm obviously not here representing them. I have been representing Minnesota's responsible gun owners at this Capitol since 1989. There really is nothing new under the sun. Let me start off with no background check can stop an evil mind or reveal undiagnosed insanity. It simply can't happen. Universal background checks haven't stopped any mass public shootings in this century. Since 2000, every one of our mass shooters obtained their weapons without using legal private transfers. Attacks such as San Bernardino massacre in California, the Yupakwa Community College shooting in Oregon, occurred in states that already have universal background checks, which wouldn't have made any difference because those guns were purchased, as all of the guns that have been purchased by these folks were purchased through an FFL dealer and went through the NICS check. Every one of these transfers, the gentleman in Virginia Tech passed, the gentleman in Northern Illinois passed, the gentleman in Aurora, California passed. Perhaps he shouldn't have. His psychiatrist was dithering around about whether she should report it, but she didn't get to it. But the next check, every one of them went through a next check. Indeed, there are mass public shootings in Europe. They've occurred in France, Belgium, Norway, Germany, and other European countries where background checks, much more rigid than ours, are already in place. The hole in the argument is so glaring that even some in the media have noticed it. Last year, ABC's John Carl asked the senator from Connecticut, why are we so focused on things that have nothing to do with the massacres we are responding to? Because, of course, the solution for a massacre that's taking place anywhere is to have a good guy with a gun there, able to act right now, right there. Because that's what it takes. Research in the U.S. has shown consistently that there's no evidence that any type of background checks reduce violent crime or outbursts of undiagnosed insanity. The research simply doesn't support it at all. And as the gentleman before me testified, there's an inherent bias in the NICS system against cultures where people have similar names.
Mr. Olson, if you want to finish up, the 15 minutes is up.
Oh, sorry about that. 94% of delays are resolved in 24 hours, and the feds prosecute less than 100 people a year. There are better ways of dealing with this. We already have in Minnesota a background check system that checks the person, not the gun, the person, not the transfer, and it's the person who's always the evil or insane party. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to clarify something based on the first testifier, Mr. Doerr. I'm a gun owner, and you do not speak for me. And so I think it's important for folks to realize when we quote the statistic about how many Minnesotans are gun owners, that even though, you know, you call yourselves the Gun Owners Caucus, that does not mean that you've spoken to every gun owner in our state. Because you don't speak for me. I've been a gun owner since I was 12 years old. And I'm also a mom. And I also think there are things we can do as we talk about good guys and bad guys. Well, the criminal background checks are to determine who those people are that you might think of as bad guys. I also want to point out, because I think you misspoke about some of the ways this would be make things difficult. The bill actually contains quite a few exclusions, including for hunting and trapping at lawfully organized shooting sports competitions and at shooting ranges. So it's not quite as draconian as it initially was made out to be. And finally, I just wanted to point out, based on the last speaker, that the majority of mass shootings and shootings in general are not perpetrated by people with mental illness. So we need to stop talking about this problem in that way. There are red flags to violent behavior and violent behavior with guns, and those red flags don't necessarily have to do with folks who are struggling with mental illness.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beckerfin, yes, I understand that not everybody may agree with us, but whether or not you agree with us, we do believe that we represent the interest of every gun owner in the state. And on your and on the point about the hunting, there are some provisions for if you're within the bill, if you're within the presence, or if you're lawfully engaged. But this bill would prevent me from being able to loan a firearm, let's say, for a weekend or a season. The language of the bill says while hunting or trapping, and that's specifically engaged in that activity. If they were to take it home, they're no longer hunting or trapping, and the loan wouldn't apply.
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is patently false to say that you speak for every gun owner in the state of Minnesota. I'm telling you now as a gun owner that that is untrue. So we need to stop saying things that are untrue.
Mr. Dorr.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beckerfin, again, I did not say we speak for every gun owner. I say we represent the interests. So you may disagree that we represent your interests. I believe we do. With respect.
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've spoken to many other constituents, family members, people that I work with. Those aren't our interests. It is false to say that. You can say that you speak for your organization, but it is patently false and untrue to state that you speak for the interests of all gun owners. You do not.
How about if we settle to agree to disagree on this?
Fair enough.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testimonies in some way were reasonable, in some ways really, really offensive. The emeritus professor spoke about the mass shootings and that those individuals have passed background checks. There are many, many other people that are shot and killed by guns that have gotten through been purchased through private sales, have been purchased through private gun shows in Hennepin County at the administration building, in the courts building. An individual was shot by someone that was able to obtain a gun through a private gun show, private sale in a gun show. So to make that accusation that it won't stop individuals is, I believe, not true. And I've heard the many arguments, well, someone wants to kill someone, they're going to find a way. In the case of mass shootings, clearly, good guys with guns don't stop them. At Parkland, there was a school resource officer deputy that never went into the building, and there were several other deputies there. So when we make these accusations that a good guy with a gun will stop these things from happening, that, again, is not true. And the argument can be made that, well, we can never regulate, we can never, you know, do things to restrict people because they're always going to do that. And I would agree. There are always going to be people that will do that. But if we reduce the ability of individuals who shouldn't have guns to get guns, it will then reduce the amount of people that we are seeing shot and killed by guns every day. So, Representative Pinto, I think this is a great bill. I would hope that we would be able to move in the directions what other reasonable states have done. I actually think this bill doesn't go far enough. It still allows people to obtain semi-automatic weapons, weapons that have predominantly been used in mass shootings. And I've heard the arguments that, you know, people use AR-15s for hunting deer. And I would say if you're that bad of a shot that you can't get them in two or three, maybe you shouldn't be able to get a dealer license.
Representative Uglem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, there's been great arguments on both sides of this bill. And obviously the lines are drawn both ways here. It's a complicated issue, and there's been lots and lots of debate. And, you know, there are real good reasons on both sides to either pass this bill or not pass this bill. There also are other bills making their way through the system here in the House and in the Senate in this session. And I think it's prudent upon this body that we look at all the bills that are coming through before we make a decision. And I just don't think it's prudent to act on something right now, Representative Pinto, you're well-intentioned, but to do something as big and as hard a decision as this in 15 or 20 minutes gives me pause. So therefore, Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to lay this bill on the table.
There's been a motion to lay the bill on the table.
Finish discussion first.
Yeah. This is a motion.
This is not debatable.
I would request a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Roll call has been requested.
Mr. Chair, you said that the motion is not debatable?
The motion is not debatable. Call the roll, please.
Johnson?
Yes.
Lohmer?
Yes.
Hillstrom?
No.
Beckerfin?
No.
Considine?
No.
Dean?
No.
Frankie?
No.
Grossel?
Yes.
Howe?
Yes.
Lucero?
Yes.
Neuberger?
Yes.
O'Neill?
Yes.
Pinto?
No.
Uglem?
Yes.
Ward? Zerwas?
There are 9 yeses, 7 noes. The motion has prevailed. Next up, we will be doing the same rules for this bill as well, under 1605. Representative Pinto, you have a motion.
Mr. Chair, again, I move that this bill simply take the next step in the process to allow the discussion to continue. The next step, which is to have the bill be re-referred to the Civil Law Committee, where the discussions and the point that was just made with the last bill can continue to go on. And so I would urge, so that's the motion that I'm making. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1605 is a second bill that would help to keep firearms away from dangerous people. We heard in the last testimony about that being the concern, is the people involved. This bill would do that while protecting the rights of the many, many, many responsible gun owners. Gun violence protective orders, or GVPOs, are a legal tool that family members and law enforcement can use when the evidence is clear that someone is posing a significant danger. In my work as a prosecutor, I see those situations, those red flags warning of danger, but nothing can be done. Well, in 5 states, including Indiana, right now, something can be done. And I'll point out, this tool, just like the last one, is used in other states. It's fully constitutional. It's being used all the time in other places, other states across the country. And that's something that can be done is a GVPO. A GVPO, again, is a request made to the court by family members or by law enforcement. And the court, in response, considers concrete evidence and past actions and assesses, is this person a significant danger? Not just a danger, but a significant danger. And these are legally really important words to other people or themselves. And are less restrictive alternatives not adequate, not appropriate? So it's not just significant danger. The court has to find the second step as well. And if so, there is a temporary prohibition on the possession of firearms. Firearms have to be transferred to someone else, not necessarily law enforcement, to a dealer, to an FFL, to another third party. And there is an exception, even in that, for certain recreational activities. A person can have firearms back for hunting, et cetera, and you can look at the bill on that. Members, there are many due process protections in the course of this bill. Making a false accusation and bringing this to court is a crime. It's perjury. It's a felony. And also, by the way, you can bring a lawsuit against the person, too, civilly and criminally liable. There is a full hearing before the order is issued. The person is allowed, person is given notice, of course. They present their side. I should note the person who's bringing the motion in the first place has the burden to show it. There can be a situation in which there's an emergency order issued, but if so, that's only if the danger is really extreme, has to be immediate, has to be imminent and present. And even then, a full hearing has to be held within days. The order is based on past conduct. The order, members, again, is temporary. And the person can certainly seek an order, getting it to be lifted. A reminder that all the constitutional rights still apply. I've seen a lot of discussion about search and seizure and various issues relating to this. They all still apply. And really, members, we're very familiar with protective orders in domestic violence situations and others, orders for protection, harassment restraining orders. This is the same process. This is a restraining order. It's the same process as those other orders when these certain circumstances apply. Members, I would urge you to listen to the testimony and to consider this tool that is being used right now in a number of other states. And I'll bring up my first testifier, Chief Schnell.
Chief Schnell, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good day. My name is Paul Schnell. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Inver Grove Heights, speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 1605. We stand firmly in support of this legislative proposal. We understand that there is no one single fix to the problem of violence perpetrated by those whom we all agree should not be in possession of a firearm. It is undoubtedly true that people who are a danger to self and or others because of mental illness should be prohibited from owning firearms. It is less clear, however, how to tailor new policies to better protect Minnesota's public while at the same time avoiding the stigmatization of those with mental illness. Any strategy to address a lethal intersection between guns and mental illness should focus on three key elements. First, there should be we need to recognize that overwhelmingly, the majority of people with mental disorders will never, ever engage in violence against others. And two, most violent behavior is due to factors other than mental illness. And three, psychiatric disorders such as depression are strongly implicated in suicide, which accounts for more than half of all gun fatalities annually. On a regular basis in Minnesota, police chiefs or sheriffs are approving permits to purchase or returning firearms to persons our officers have dealt with, and in some cases placed on an involuntary transport hold for psychiatric evaluation. Many chiefs have been in the uncomfortable position of having family members request that guns previously taken for safekeeping be held because their family member or loved one remains unstable. Despite these requests by concerned family members and the articulable belief that the person reflects a true and present danger to self or other, the current law demands that guns be returned to the person for lack of a qualifying reason to withhold the return of those guns. We believe that a gun violence protection order is a de-escalation tactic that will ultimately address these issues. We believe that the GVPO will provide us with a tool that can help us keep our community safe in what we know to be rare situations. Even while these situations may be rare, I would remind everyone that today there is a community in Florida that wishes that any and all tools available to them would or could have been explored. The Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association urges your support of House File 1605. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'll bring up the next testifier, Sheriff Jack Sirier.
Sheriff, please state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jack Sirier, S-E-R-I-E-R, and I am coming to you today. I'm speaking to you as the Ramsey County Sheriff. I've been in Minnesota law enforcement for 28 years, and I spent 12 years working the street, some of which were out the front door of this building as a member of the St. Paul Police Department. So I've had a firsthand view of the fear and concerns that law enforcement officers and family members have for those who are in crisis and have access to firearms. As sheriff, it is my role as an executive of a law enforcement agency to abide by the laws of the state, no matter what they are. I cannot pick or choose which laws to enforce or to overextend my reach as a public official. As such, I would like to advocate for the Gun Violence Protection Order bill being offered by Representative Pinto. This is a common sense bill that will allow those closest to a crisis situation to request a due process hearing about the status of a person's possession of firearms when family or law enforcement witness behaviors that are putting the person subject to the order, their own life in jeopardy, or the lives of loved ones around them in danger. We in law enforcement find ourselves close to many situations where the law falls short of protecting people from themselves or creating better safety nets for others around them. The behaviors we see from some people often leave us concerned and lacking the tools to intervene as we see a situation build to what, at times, becomes a tragic ending. I'm asking for your consideration of House File 1605 as a common sense measure to ensure the safety of people in our communities here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Sheriff Sarah. Thank you. Mr. Chair, the next testifier is Mary Brock.
You state your name for the record?
Yes. My name is Merritt Brock, B-R-O-C-K. I live in St. Paul. I'm a volunteer with Moms Demand Action, a mom, and I'm a gun violence survivor. I'm here today in honor of my brother, who died by suicide with a gun, and to urge you to support gun violence protective orders. My brother was the baby of our family. His name was Philip, but everyone called him Pip, even when he grew into a big bear of a man. He's a Minnesota guy, through and through. He loved hunting, fishing, camping, skiing. Whatever got him outdoors, he loved it. Unfortunately, on August 21st, 2001, he took the hunting gun that our grandfather had given him and shot and killed himself. He was 26 when he died. Today's his birthday. He'd be 43 today. My brother's death made me an activist dedicated to preventing suicide. And over the years, I've met so many people worried about a loved one in crisis. And one woman in particular comes to mind because she was terrified for her adult son. He'd stopped taking his medication. His behavior was erratic. He refused to give up his guns. And when they went to law enforcement, they were told that there's nothing that they could do unless something happened. She was terrified for her son, his wife, and their kids because she knew if they waited until something happened, it would be too late. Currently in Minnesota, there's no action that a family member can take regarding red flags. Between 2012 and 2016, 3,400 Minnesota residents have died by suicide, and nearly half of those have been with a gun. You heard earlier that the primary amount of gun deaths in Minnesota is gun suicide. Gun violence protective orders would allow family members, who are usually the first to see red flags, to alert law enforcement, who can then take action to seek a protective order to temporarily remove guns from people in a dangerous situation. This is law in a number of other states across the country. It's tested. And a 2017 study of Connecticut's law estimated that more than 72 people are alive today thanks to their law. I know that there's not one law that will end all gun deaths, and this law wouldn't have prevented my brother's death, but I know that gun violence protective orders will save lives in Minnesota, and I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I'll call up the final testifier.
Please state your name for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Eva Goldfarb. I'm a junior at St. Louis Park High School. Thank you guys for this opportunity to speak to you from my position as a student. A few days after Parkland, I went to bed and I had a dream where my own school was targeted by a shooting. When I went to tell my friends, a lot of them said they had the same dream. I wanted to say, gosh, what a horrible nightmare, but I realized it can't even be classified as a nightmare, because even though it has monsters and terror, nightmares aren't real. This is all too real, and we know it too well, and we've known it for too long. We know that if people who are dangerous can't have a gun, then they can't shoot people. Why are we surprised every time a person with a semi-automatic assault weapon fires on a crowd of people and kills so many? This is now a regular occurrence. We, the students, call on you to enact preventative gun control laws like GVPO. I say preventative because my best friend's father committed homicide and suicide, and it could have been prevented with a bill like this. She could still have her mother and her grandmother today if this process was used. It could have been prevented. You are our legislators, and it is your job to keep us safe from gun violence in our schools and in our movie theaters, our universities, our concerts, our churches, synagogues, and mosques, on our streets, and in our communities. We are asking you to prevent shooters before they've done their damage. Make it possible to remove the guns that enable dangerous people to kill. If there are red flags about a person, their family or community police or peers know they might be dangerous, then the law must allow family and police to prevent them from having a gun. I know of an 8-year-old girl that asked her mom for new sneakers because she realized her light-up Skecher ones would give away her location in the case of a school shooting. How much are our lives worth to you? Because we are committed. Gun reform is no longer a question of if, but a question of when, and the answer is right now. Please vote yes on this bill and allow for gun violence protection orders as one way of helping to keep us safe. You may think students will lose interest in this issue, but we won't. Not until we can learn about how to better the world around us instead of learning how to lock the door and hide in the corner as quickly as possible. Not until that little girl can wear Skechers without the fear of getting killed. Not until thoughts are replaced with action and prayers replaced with laws. Another thing I wanted to quickly mention is a big theme that I've heard in people's testimonies as well as conversations I've had with people outside in the halls is the theme of this burden that these bills impose on them, of having to go through longer and more bureaucratic processes that make it harder. But if I'm being honest, we have a burden too. It is a burden for us to go through these lockdowns regularly. It is a burden for us to have to plan walkouts. It is a burden for us to wake up and go about our regular lives with the fear that we may be shot. It is far beyond just a burden for us and these families of victims to grieve the losses of their loved ones. So with all due respect, and I don't want to minimize the validity of this burden, but my safety and the safety of my peers and the safety of everyone is worth the burden. Thank you for your attention.
Just to conclude, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, no one policy change would prevent every one of the deaths that have been described today. Of course not. But these are both reasonable steps that are in use across the country and that are saving lives today while still fully protective of the rights of gun owners. In the domestic violence fatalities and homicides that take up so much of gun deaths, in the cases that I prosecute, the good guy with a gun is not going to be helpful. That's in a situation where someone who has shown in their behavior that they are dangerous, right now we don't have that tool. This would give us that tool. I would urge you, members, to continue this bill through the process, to have the next hearing in the process to continue, because I think everyone in the room would agree we need something like this. And if your problem is the details, let's keep working on it, move it through the process. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next, we have Rob Dorr.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Gun violence restraining orders.
State your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Rob Dorr, D-O-A-R, with the Gun Owners Caucus, political director. Gun violence restraining orders are a noble idea. We support finding ways that family members can intercede with people who they think are at risk. And we are willing to be part of that conversation and ready to be part of that conversation. But our concerns can, as you can guess by our buttons, can be summed up with two words, due process. The process of gun violence restraining orders that we particularly object to are the ex parte provisions, which allow, based on an accusation, for somebody's firearms to be seized from them and then justified, have their chance to have their day in court and justify whether or not they should or should not be able to repossess their property. Our Constitution guarantees that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process. This bill is confiscation without due process, period. If this bill were to become law, an individual's constitutional rights would be violated not because of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, not even clear and convincing evidence, but mere preponderance of the evidence. That of only one side of the story, preponderance of the evidence of only one person's side of the story, they can have their property and their gun rights, their right to self-defense taken away from them. The potential of abuse for this is egregious. Because this bill violates the Second, Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, we vehemently oppose this bill and encourage every member to vote to table it.
Next, Sarah Cade. Please state your name for the record and continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Cade. I'm a resident of Maplewood, Minnesota, a healthcare professional and recreational shooter. I'm a volunteer activist, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the members of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus and Political Action Committee. We oppose this legislation. HF 1605, the Guilty Until Proven Innocent bill, completely guts the concept of due process. This bill allows civil rights to be stripped without representation, without even your knowledge, and without the chance to present evidence on your behalf. Since it only requires a preponderance of evidence, an extremely low burden of proof that is normally used in civil trials. The Second Amendment is a constitutionally protected fundamental human right, and this bill treats it like an episode of Judge Judy. Rights matter, even and especially when they're controversial. Many of the people in the gallery today came over from the pro-choice lobby day. They understand better than anyone that controversial rights need the protections of our system the most. And it's not just controversial rights, but controversial people who need that protection. And this is not a purely philosophical debate for me. I grew up in a family with domestic abuse, and I have lived the terror of hiding in a battered women's shelter, afraid of what would happen if we were found. But the rights we're discussing today are bigger than my fears. Due process is the foundation of a just legal system. It's vitally important to protect it from erosion, and that same protection applies equally to everyone. When it comes to suicide, I can tell you this bill would do more harm than good. Most people in Minnesota commit suicide with firearms they already own. So that means they're gun owners like us. We're your friends and your neighbors. If you want to help us, the first thing you need to do is understand us. Most gun owners believe, and research shows, that the best methods for suicide prevention are proactive and they're voluntary. Laws like this drive gun owners away from mental health treatment and make us less likely to reach out for help, whether that be treatment for depression, PTSD, marriage counseling, or any of the everyday problems we all share. If you were to ask how many people here know someone who chose not to seek help for fear their medical records would someday be used against them, I bet you would see a lot of hands in the air. We're all in this together, and we need to address these problems as a community. Laws like this only create more stigma and discourage people from reaching out. This is an unseen problem, but our lives matter too. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I know you're under a lot of pressure to do something, but that doesn't mean you have to act recklessly without considering the cost of these proposals. This bill is dangerous and it's counterproductive. As lawmakers, your constituents rely on you to carefully consider the unintended consequences and make a decision that protects the rights of all Minnesotans. Please vote against HF 1605. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
I can hold my questions till the end, Mr. Chair, after they have the other testifiers. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. If everybody could wait their questions till the end. Kara Schultz.
Committee persons, members of the audience, I'm Kara Schultz, and I'm here representing the Libertarian Party of Minnesota. Libertarians ascribe to an ethic of assuming good faith until proven otherwise, and I mention this because we believe every person in this room is here because we all have this shared wish for a peaceful society, and so do we. But we do have significant concerns regarding HF 1605. While we do not believe it is the author's intent, this bill is discriminatory in its nature towards minorities and persons in lower socioeconomic classes. A wealthier person is able to easily hire an attorney, experts, that type of thing, to defend themselves against accusations that they pose a danger and they can recover their civil rights. Lower income persons would be at a serious disadvantage. As for minorities, well, we did hear from Ben Rust, who works with gun trust and firearms issues as an attorney, and he notes the majority of his clients who need to take legal action to recover their rights regarding firearms are often named Mohammed, and that's not a coincidence. We also have concerns regarding inadequate due process. A person can be stripped of their rights first due to someone's feeling they may pose a danger, and then they have to go to court to recover their rights, and we feel that that is backwards in the process. Now, there is a standard used by court, which also has a concern for us, which is preponderance. And that means a judge just needs to feel about 51% that a person could possibly be a danger. And that standard is far too low for something as serious as stripping away a person's civil rights. We are concerned that this bill is ripe for abuse. Not only could feuding family members use it as a way to retaliate against one another, if you've been in family law, you've seen this, or try to gain possession of valuable family heirloom firearms, it could be used in very tragic ways. Now, if a wife were to leave her husband due to abuse and purchase a firearm for protection, an estranged husband could use this process to disarm her. Well, we see there is a provision in the bill that speaks to these false allegations, and we appreciate that. We all know that this is extremely notoriously difficult to prove and prosecute. Now, we can see the aim of this bill looks squarely at mental illness, but we believe the results would be counter to what the bill's authors hope to achieve. Provisions that allow for notice to be served in a local newspaper would broadcast to the public that the named person is mentally ill and dangerous. Provisions which allow a person's private medical records to be given to police would make people far less likely to seek assistance if they need help, and less likely to discuss serious health concerns like depression or anxiety with their family doctor. The entire bill, unfairly, according to every scrap of research available, stigmatizes those with mental health challenges as violent and untrustworthy. We question the focus of this bill. If the goal of the bill is to protect the public from people who pose such a danger to themselves or others that a court must take emergency action, the bill would be about removing the person to a safe location for 72 hours for evaluation by trained medical professionals, not leaving them on the streets where they still pose a danger to themselves and others. Now, Minnesota already has a law to involuntarily evaluate someone suspected of posing a danger to themselves or others over a 72 period. And that is the tool which could be utilized, not just for public safety, but to compassionately offer mental health services to those in desperate need. The Libertarian Party of Minnesota opposes this bill due to its discriminatory nature, potential for abuse, inadequate due process before stripping a citizen of a civil right, violations of medical privacy, stigmatization of mental illness, and ineffectual focus. Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Joe Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, I'm Joseph Olson. I'm president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance of Minnesota. We represent the interests of Minnesota's 250, 2.5 million
law-abiding gun owners. We don't represent all of them, and there are members in our group who differ with the majority position. That's the way politics plays out. I was struck by the first witness who testified in favor of the bill. She testified about a young man who needed medication, a young man who committed suicide. We've all seen the billboards. Stop suicides. Treat depression. Well, there's nothing in this bill that does that. We're going to force people to give up their property, but we refuse to force them to get medical treatment. And I think one thing the testimony has brought out is, you know, the solution is forcing these folks who need mental health care to get it. This bill doesn't do that. Now, let's talk about suicides for just one more minute. In Minnesota, about 80% of firearms homicides are suicides. The Canadian government, after they passed a rigorous restriction bill on firearms in 1975, went out 3 years later and had some researchers do a study. And their conclusion was, Canadians appear to have fully substituted suicide by leaping. I had an 86-year-old widow lady who lives two doors down from me, who was old, lonely. Her family had grown away from her. She was depressed, and she used clothesline. So there are plenty of substitutes available to people who are determined to take their lives. But to focus on this bill, which I believe doesn't deal with the problem, which is mental health, I think the biggest difficulty is the burden of proof provisions. You have a scale of justice. They're equally weighted. You clip a bit off of your fingernail, and you drop it in one of the trays, and lo and behold, you have a preponderance of the evidence. So we're taking away a constitutional right. We're making a whole bunch of criminal penalties relating to the taking away of the constitutional right on the basis of a nail clipping. Yes, I know I'm overstating it. This is testimony. So I think that is a really serious problem. I think allowing the petition to go to the court without first having gone through the police and having an investigation and a separate judgment made by someone who is not emotionally traumatized as to whether the action should go forward is something that I think that should be seriously considered. I notice on the list of factors, history of mental health evaluations is not in here. Now, sometimes it will be unavailable, but certainly if it is unavailable in these proceedings, the legislature has the power to make it available. And I notice we have some, for some of these things, you have to be arrested. For some of them, you have to be convicted. For other ones, just anybody's opinion seems to be good enough. That I find as a significant concern. And given the, I know we're running out of time, given the overall impact of the bill, take a look at the top of page 6 if you want to. I'll tell you what it says. If the individual wants to get or have extended a permit, they have to carry the burden of preponderance of the evidence. The victim of the order, that is the person who has had his constitutional right property taken away from him, has to prove, even after 5 years, that he's a good guy, or she is a good person, by clear and convincing evidence. This bill is designed to make it easy to take property away and hard to get it back. even after a great number of years. That, I think, has due process problems. But basically, the bill is...
Professor Olson, we just finish up. You have about 15 seconds.
I'm good at that. CARE 11 had a report last night on a woman who had OFP orders. And the gentleman that was her attacker was ordered to surrender to them. He didn't. No affidavit was filed. No enforcement effort was ever taken. They had a long article on the fact that they don't get it done. Not even 2% in Hennepin County. Right now, no one is checking. So an order that doesn't do anything isn't going to advance safety very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinto, you and I have worked on a lot of legislation together. I respect you. I like working with you. You're an intelligent, articulate man. We've even worked in the area of violence and things like that. And yet I wish this was written differently. You know, you had said that, well, kind of overlook the problems and the details. And if you know me, I cannot do that. I cannot overlook the details. And I have so many notes and so many detail issues that I don't even have time to go into them, Representative Pinto. This bill has significant issues, and I don't say that lightly. I have studied this bill. In fact, last night, you ask anybody, I had 5 statute books open on my desk, cross-referencing, trying to fully understand what you're trying to accomplish here. I understand the issue. I understand the concern. I understand that we're in a situation that we don't want to be in. We're in a society that has kind of gone over the edge. I understand all that. And I would love to work, and I have worked. You and I have worked together to try to get to some of those core issues. You and I worked in the area of violence together. And right now I'm actually looking at civil commitment statutes. So I'm working with Representative Keel on reforming our civil commitment statutes. Now, you understand that our civil commitment statutes really do get at what you're talking about here. If someone is a danger to themselves or others, they can be taken into custody. They can go and be evaluated. They can go through a 72-hour process. We already have a very robust, and we are still working to make it more robust, system of civil commitment. So if someone truly is a danger to themselves, intimate danger to themselves or others, we have that avenue. As I said about domestic violence, we also have that avenue. You know that the OFP statute that you and I talked about and worked on has a situation that if that woman feels that she is in danger from guns, that those guns can be removed through a court order. And it is a due process, and they can have their court time. So there is that avenue as well. But as I'm getting into the details, Representative Pinto, the very first thing I did is I looked to see where did you draft this legislation to? And I was just confounded. I don't understand. I mean, it could have been in 609. It could have been in 154. But you put it in 245. You put it in the Department of Human Services chapter. And specifically to follow mental illness crisis housing. And more specifically, immediately thereafter, in adult mental illness crisis housing assistance program. And I know Representative Becker Finn had said that we want to be so clear that mental illness, and I don't want to misquote you, but we don't want to further stigmatize those with mental illness. And yet it's drafted, and it broke my heart when I looked at that. It's like it's drafted to the mental illness crisis housing part of statute. And I don't know what other message you can send, but that. Let's go to the testifier had talked briefly about page 6. I don't know that I've ever read this in statute before. It says the respondent, so the person that's had their guns taken away, has the burden to prove that they are not dangerous. Where in our justice system do you have to prove that you are not guilty? I don't even have words. And let's just take this a step further. Representative Pinto, not only do we have the civil commitment statutes, we have the domestic violence statutes. You've put it into the mental illness section of law. You have put a burden on the person that had their guns taken away to prove that they're not dangerous. But the language to say that they could possibly be dangerous, they haven't actually done anything, but there's a potential that maybe they could be. I find that highly problematic. They have done nothing, but they could possibly be. There's an old movie about that, and it's this crazy technology that came out, and I don't know what year it was, and it says, well, we can see into the future, and we know that this person is going to commit a crime, so we're going to incarcerate them. I almost feel like that's where we are. The last thing I'd like for you to address is I want you to explain to those in the room and the committee who the ineligible people already are. This is a part of this particular law change that you're trying to do. And the list is long. I don't know if you even have time to go through the whole list of who already are ineligible to possess or purchase a gun. But the list is very, very long, including anybody with any drug possession, use of any drug, any juvenile that had any violent crime of any kind, anybody that is, according to statute 253B.02, is defined as mentally ill, developmentally disabled, or mentally ill and dangerous. I mean, the list goes on and on and on of who is not eligible to even possess a gun. And I'm not really sure who's left other than people that we might think possibly could maybe hurt somebody. I really don't understand. As I've read this over and over and over, I just don't. You had said, you know, overlook the details. I can't overlook the details. And that's just the high, I could go for an hour talking about this, but that's just the high level things that I have really great concerns about. Not a due process that was mentioned before. So we can do an ex parte hearing, which means the defendant isn't even there, to determine whether or not he is dangerous or she is dangerous and take their guns away. There is only one other instance in law that says we can do an ex parte hearing, and it is in the most narrow of circumstances when a woman who is in abused terribly, she's terrified of that man, and she can petition the court to have an ex parte hearing. I don't know any other part of law where we allow an ex parte hearing, but you do here. Representative Pinto, I'm sorry, but this is beyond overlooking a few details.
Representative Pinto, would you like to respond?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. And we have had the chance to work on a lot of these issues together. I'll try to address a few of the points that you raised. I think it's really important to recognize that this is modeled on the very orders for protection that you just referenced, right? It's a very, very similar process. This is not, is somebody possibly dangerous? This is there concrete evidence that is presented to a court under oath with penalty of perjury for a court to consider, with the burden being on the petitioner, not on the person in question, but on the petitioner, to say that this person is a significant, well, I'll get to the burden on the respondent in a second, but is the person a significant danger, and is there not an alternative that is adequate, that is possible, that can be used? That is the basic structure of this, and that's the same as the order for protection. As far as where it's put in statute, that is the purpose. And the focus is the dangerousness, members, of the person involved. What you point to about the respondent having their own burden back is that a court, and this again is the same as an order for protection, a court issues an order. That order is sitting out there that says, as a result of all that process, it is true, then the respondent may at that point come back before the order expires. Remember, it's a temporary order, and may at that point have the burden. That's the same as any respondent on any court order once the order is issued. So I want to make sure we're really clear that that burden on the respondent comes after a court has issued an order with that full process. Ex parte orders for protection are issued many times a day. I'm kind of looking at Representative Becker Finn, who also practices in this area. And that piece of it, it's something that is a common thing. The issue here is the danger has to be immediate and present. It is a high standard for doing it. But overall, Representative O'Neill, the point that I would make is this is an important situation. This is a crisis. This is a short session. I want to work with you on any of the details you want to and any of the members. The next stop for this bill is civil law. Let's keep on working on this. Absolutely. Every part of this, absolutely. This bill was introduced a year ago. I was waiting for a hearing until now. It seemed really important to have it. I would love to continue working with you and with your colleagues. This is an idea that is in use in other states right now. It's fully constitutional. It's happening there. It's an idea that we should consider here, and I'm happy to work with you to finalize it, to make it happen in our state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, when testifier Mr. Doar spoke, he spoke about life. And I think that that's what this is about. It's about life. And we have not been doing our part as legislators in protecting life of those in our state. We seem to have elevated the issue of guns above protecting life. And we didn't do anything after Sandy Hook. My fear is we're not going to do anything now. And to you, Eva, keep fighting, because I'm not so sure we're going to get there. And if we don't get there, tell all your friends to run against us and get us out of here so we can begin to make this change.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pinto, you know, I started marking this thing up, and there's too many marks here to go through them all, but I do have one question. Was this done for you up here on the screen? Is this supposed to be accurate?
It is supposed to be accurate, Representative Howell, but do you see an inaccuracy there? Well, please be pointed out if you do see something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the first one, I didn't get up through them all. I just stopped at the first one because if that one was wrong, I kind of figured the rest of them would probably be in question. So it says that making a false accusation is a felony-level crime. But yet here on line 931 says it's a misdemeanor. So I'll stop right there.
And Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, what I want to make clear is that perjury is in fact a felony. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. And Mr. Chair, if I could point out that some materials were left up by somebody who was testifying against the bill, including a cell phone, I just want to make sure that that is not forgotten when anybody leaves. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've talked about the hearing, but as the former law enforcement people can tell you, that if they run across somebody, they can take them directly to the hospital, and they will put them under a 72-hour hold. And you alluded to it, as did the lady, the libertarian, and that seems to be preferable, to lock them up for 72 hours rather than take the guns and do an assessment. Which one is more onus? In one, you get an assessment. In the other one, you lock them up. I would suggest that just taking the guns is a lot less intrusive than locking them up for 72 hours.
Mr. Chair, to that point?
Representative O'Neill, I also could answer that one myself.
If you would allow me some latitude.
Go ahead. I'm going to respond on that one as well.
Very well, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So I live in a duplex, and my next-door neighbor over the summer was quite distraught. Native American, felt very isolated, was going through a divorce. I would see family members come and go. One night I remember three of his older adult children standing on the sidewalk. It was really hot. It was September. And I just quickly just said hello. I didn't really know for sure who they were. But what they were doing is they were doing an intervention. And they had just walked out of this intervention with him. He had been sober for 14 years and had recently relapsed and had downward spiraled very, very quickly. 2 days after, that was on a Friday evening. 2 days after that, I left for the weekend. I went away on a Saturday. He went into the garage that we share and set up a ladder and a rope, and he hung himself. Had I known that that's what he was going to do, you're darn right, I would have called the police. I would have put him and made sure that he was committed for 72 hours. And there are so many people just like myself that have encountered that, that yes, they want to, just taking the guns out of the home doesn't mean that they're not going to commit suicide. There's plenty of other ways to either hurt themselves or other people. And maybe it's more onerous, but at least they're getting treatment. They're getting care. When I used to do jail ministry and I was the preacher in the jail, I used to say, you know what? You need to look at this as a pause button. This is an opportunity for you to pause your life and to think about it and reflect and maybe make a different choice. So I don't see this as more onerous. I think civil commitment is a pause for them to actually, one, save their life or someone else and actually get to the issue. Because I think had he actually been committed, maybe we would have a different outcome right now. Maybe I'd have this very lovely middle-aged man still next door that would bring my trash can in when I needed. And he was an absolute lovely, wonderful man. I miss him terribly. So, yes, there are certainly circumstances where we need to do the civil commitment. Just taking the guns away may or may not solve the issue.
I worked on content as well on those 72-hour holds. Law enforcement does not do the 72-hour hold. They do a transport order. They bring them in the doors. I brought in many, and many times they were going out the doors after evaluation before I was done with my report. Not a lot of them were actually held for that 72 hours, and it's not a full 72 hours unless needed.
Again, Mr. Chair, I worked in locked institutions for 28 years. I understand how it works, but you took them in without even a court hearing, and my point is that yes, sometimes it is necessary, and it works. Sometimes removing the weapons also would be a logical step that would work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think it's pretty obvious that this bill is very controversial, and we've heard great arguments on both sides. My motion will not kill this bill. My motion is, again, to lay it on the table. And obviously, there's much more work to be done. I think this committee, I know that I want to hear more about this from other testifiers. Again, we're looking at a very limited time frame that we've allowed Representative Pinto to come here and make his case. This is tremendous, has tremendous implications for the First Amendment. And so I think it's really on us to do some more work here, and therefore I would make a motion to lay this on the table, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, lay on the table. I would request a roll call.
We will have a roll call.
Johnson.
Aye.
Lohmer.
Yes.
Hillstrom.
No.
Becker Finn.
No.
Considine.
No.
Dean.
No.
Frankie?
Yes.
Grossel?
Yes.
Howe?
Yes.
Lucero?
Yes.
Neuberger?
Yes.
O'Neill? Pinto?
No.
Uglum?
Yes.
Ward? And Zerwas?
Ten ayes, six nays. Bill is laid on the table. I want to thank everybody for Representative Becker Finn.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I this needs to be stated no matter where the bill is going. So if you'll allow me just a minute. This bill is not just about people harming themselves. There's been very little actual discussion because of the limitations that have been placed on the discussion about domestic violence. And the folks that testified earlier, I think they're the ones that actually made the copy of this article from CARE 11 about the enforcement of orders for protection, which do relate to firearms. And if folks will remember last session, I asked a lot of questions about this. And so I'm working on language on how to fix this, and I hope that those who spoke to this will work with me to fix these loopholes, because this isn't just about people with mental illness and 72-hour holds. This is also about protecting women and other victims of violence to quickly keep themselves safe and to defuse a situation. So do not forget those folks in this discussion. Thank you.
Good point. We will be adjourned.